Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Carl Greenfield knew from an early age that his brother Noah wasn't like other children. He couldn't talk, make eye contact, or tie his shoes. Then came a diagnosis of autism that devastated the family and changed it forever. Greenfield grew up to be a successful editor and writer. He's now speaking out about what it was like to grow up with an autistic brother. This hour On Point, growing up in the shadow of autism. You can join the conversation. Do you have a brother or a sister with autism or another profound disability? What has the experience been like for you? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York City is journalist and writer Carl Greenfield. His new memoir is Boy Alone, A Brother's Memoir. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Carl Greenfield, welcome to On Point.
Hi there.
Your brother Noah was perhaps the most famous autistic child in the 1970s. There was extensive coverage of him and your family. Your dad wrote three books about Noah. How is your account different?
Well, you're right. My father's books, the most famous of which was A Child Called Noah, were the first to really describe what it was like to be the father of a profoundly autistic boy and to really recount honestly the difficulty and struggle that my family went through. As useful as that book was and as important as that book was, it still didn't give the sibling perspective. So then when I got old enough and began to try to piece together the impact Noah had had in my life and my childhood, I realized I had a different story to tell. Similar, we're in the same family, but my perspective on the experience was in some ways different and in some ways, I think, more useful to many families today.
Hmm. In the first paragraph of your book, you introduce us to Noah and his world. If you would you read that for us?
Sure. A boy sits by himself on a stained white carpet, the corner of a frayed blanket stuffed into his mouth, his head bobbing, the fingers of both hands twiddling at ear level. He seems neither to miss company nor show any eagerness to seek it. If you say hello, he will not look at you nor turn in the direction of your voice. If you take a position in his line of sight, he will look away.
Do you remember your first interaction with your brother Noah, who was severely autistic?
I'm only a year and a half older than Noah, so my childhood recollection does not go back in much detail to that point. I was very aware from very early in childhood that Noah was a pressing concern in my family, and much of the conversation and focus went into initially what Noah wasn't doing, what was wrong with Noah. I understood that Noah was supposed to be doing certain things. He was supposed to be crawling. He was supposed to be walking. He was supposed to be standing up, and he was missing these developmental milestones. And so I was aware that my parents were having this sort of deep and furrowed brow conversation about what was wrong with Noah. And so very early, I understood that Noah wasn't like other children, wasn't like other boys, and that we had a sick child in the family, so to speak. I mean, initially my parents told me when they first began to take Noah around to specialists that Noah was sick. That was the explanation they gave, because as a 3-year-old or as a 4-year-old, how could I understand what Noah's disability was? But what that meant in a strange way is that very early on, I was brought into this family conversation about Noah, about what we were going to do with Noah, about what might work with Noah, what might be wrong with Noah. And I felt myself shifting already, probably around 5 or 6 years old, into a caregiver role for my younger brother instead of a playmate role, which I think is more normal at that age.
Mm. Shifting into a caregiver role, and how did you take that? I mean, you identify in the memoir, you're very honest about these feelings of rage and confusion and love. I mean, how was that?
I don't think I was in a position to really understand at the time what my feelings were. This was my family. This was my only brother. So the experience was what the experience was. Now, and this is one reason I didn't write Boy Alone, until I was in my 40s, because now that I have children of my own, I have a 9-year-old, excuse me, I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, both daughters, both thankfully normal, I realize how much of that normal sibling experience I had missed. I realized how distorted in many ways my own childhood had been because of the disproportionate concern and worry about Noah. I think my parents were always careful to try to find that right balance and to try to not make me feel as if somehow I were the less advantaged or I was getting less attention. But, I mean, let's face it, even in normal families, you struggle to find the right balance of how much attention you give one brother or sister versus the other brother or sister. I think it's always you're overcompensating, undercompensating. You never feel like you're getting it right as a parent. In my parents' case, that was even more difficult because it was clear that Noah was the needier party. Mm-hmm. So they naturally, you know, did whatever they could for Noah and tried to find the right balance and tried to give me the attention. But they did an admirable job. They did everything they could. I think it's in the nature of families that have this kind of profound disability within it for the family to focus more on the neediest member. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book and felt that this was an important book, because I think there are so many families that have one member who does need more attention and does need more parental resources. So, and it's very easy for other siblings to feel occasionally that they're somehow diminished or less important.
So describe the day-to-day process of caring for Noah growing up and your contribution to that.
I think a lot of your listeners who have autistic children can imagine this. Our house was sort of in a state of perpetual tumult. Noah chewed up all the furniture. He chewed up any clothes that were lying around. He turned over tables. He knocked over glasses. I think we very carefully tried to moderate his diet so that he would only eat healthier foods. We had to change our schedule around because Noah tended not to sleep very well. Noah was never a very deep or long sleeper. So my parents were sort of up and down all night trying to care for him. Noah wasn't toilet trained until I guess he was six or seven. And so we were sort of constantly trying to monitor him and see if he was going to the bathroom, when he might be going to the bathroom. And I was drawn into almost all of these roles in terms of sort of a third set of eyes for my parents to keep track of Noah and to try to monitor and regulate him a little bit.
Your family story was profiled twice on 60 Minutes on CBS, and the first time was in 1978. We have a clip of that. You were 13 years old. And you read a poem that you wrote about your brother Noah.
Knowing Noah everywhere, it goes around just like air. And when you hear a sacred tune, you'll know it come around the room. And when he comes to stay, he'll only stay his way.
As I mentioned, there was extensive coverage of your family, not only 60 Minutes, print journalists, authors, always coming around to interview your family. How was that for you, that early attention? Did you tire of that attention? Did you tire of being in his shadow in this particular way?
I think initially I accepted it as part of who my father was and who my brother was, and that my father, in deciding to write about our family, had brought on this kind of attention. I think as I entered into adolescence and became more aware of peer group pressure, I was less comfortable with it and less happy with the fact that my family was renowned really for having an autistic or disabled member. My parents were doing this in part because they were trying to raise awareness and trying to shed some light on a subject that in the 60s and 70s wasn't very well understood and very often discussed. Mm-hmm. And my father felt and my mother felt that it was important to talk openly about this. Because if you remember, we were coming out of a period when many families would hide their disabilities. People didn't like to publicly talk about the struggles in the family. And that's one of the reasons A Child Called Noah, my father's first book, and A Place for Noah, his second book, were so important, because it was one of the first times a father had come out and spoken about the difficulty my family was having. That said, as a teenager, I don't think you ever like to really feel that you're different or that you're somehow not part of the mainstream, not part of the norm. For whatever reasons, and I think family shame is a common part of the teenage experience at some point. We all seem to be embarrassed by our parents at a certain age. And I think the fact that my family was on TV all the time, and that, you know, we were in magazine stories. And I remember the day after the 60 Minutes piece aired was a very embarrassing day for me at school. 60 Minutes in the 70s was such a big show. And I did feel like, well, I became known as Noah's brother, which was not always the – I would rather have been known as something wonderful and cool in my own right. But that wasn't happening. So I think what I went through was a very typical version of teenage angst, only with the addition of being more self-conscious because of who Noah was.
You say in the book that every achievement or underachievement was scrutinized by your parents against the backdrop of your brother's disability. You say in the book, Noah was rewarded for ringing a bell, you write, but I am not allowed to go outside or play because I can't do my multiplication tables yet. How long did that sort of conflict or that sort of relationship that last? Was it your whole childhood?
Well, I mean, that's not a conflict between me and Noah. I mean, let's make clear. I'm just observing the inequity, in some sense, of the standards that are being applied to Noah and applied to me. I think that's an example of my parents trying to find the right balance in our family. How much extra burden are they putting on me to be more normal because Noah is somehow quote unquote abnormal? And so I think it's inevitable that as a child, and when you become more aware, children have a very strong sense of equality. I've noticed that in my own daughters. And I couldn't help but notice, well, I mean, Noah seems to be allowed to sort of come and go as he wants with much less demands placed upon him, in part because he is harder to make demands of. And so I couldn't help but notice at some point, well, why am I expected to perform above average when Noah's expected to perform below average? So I think there's awareness of that, but in no way is that a resentment of Noah. That's just the reality of living with a profoundly autistic sibling.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Carl Greenfeld about his new memoir, Boy Alone, and his experience of growing up with an autistic brother. In a 2000 interview on 60 Minutes, Carl, your father shared some thoughts from another parent of a developmentally disabled child. Here's what he told your dad.
We're the only parents in the world who somehow wish and pray fervently for a offspring to predecease us. And there's truth in that, because, you know, if he's gone, then it's easier for us to go psychologically. It really is.
Carl, can you describe from your parents' perspective, but also from your perspective as a brother, that constant worry, that constant need to make sure he's okay, not only in childhood, but now in adulthood?
This is the central conversation of my family, and this is what my book is about. I want families to understand as they go through this journey, and it's not just the childhood journey, it's the adult journey, the adult autistic, that to understand they're not alone in trying to figure out how to navigate this. And because there is no right way to get through this. You can get through it, and you do get through it. And what Boy Alone is about how a family does get through this journey, you know, one day at a time, and it's not always easy. But this remains a central focus of my parents and of our lives. And I think what my father said was the great concern of many parents, that nothing can replace parental love for a son or daughter. And parents know this. I'm Noah's brother, and I love Noah, but I love him as a brother loves him. I love him in that different sense. And inevitably, part of that kind of brotherly love is sibling rivalry. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe I will ever be as selfless toward Noah as my parents are. I don't believe I can ever replace my parents in Noah's life. I believe I will always be in Noah's life, and then Noah will always be in my life. I believe I'll always be his keeper. But I can never replace them. And I think that's the great fear that my father is expressing in that powerful statement, which is parents know this. Mm-hmm. And I will stand in for my parents as much as I can, but I'm not going to replace my parents. And And when Noah is challenging me or spitting at me or scratching me or pulling my hair, I won't always stay there for that. I'll walk out on him for a day if I have to. And I think that's maybe the difference between what a brother will do and what a father will do. I'm always struck by how many brothers and sisters of normal siblings can turn their backs on them. People whose brothers are in jail, people whose brothers are become addicts or criminals or whatever, they can turn their back on their brother. I can never turn my back on Noah, in part because somehow I don't see Noah as responsible for his own dilemma or condition. So therefore, I have to always be there for him. But what that means is I have to ultimately have more sympathy and perseverance in my love for Noah than I would for any normal sibling. Mm.
You use the word sibling rivalry, and you actually write about this a lot, and how despite or perhaps because of Noah's disability, the two of you were locked in this titanic battle. Can you read a little bit about that, page 10?
I don't see it as a titanic battle with my brother. I mean, I love my brother deeply, and he's going to be in my life in a more profound way than probably almost any brother other brother combination that I know.
Yeah.
I think there is sibling rivalry. I don't know if it's any greater or less than what a normal sibling rivalry is.
Could you read page 10?
You're my brother and my rival, and I can feel the room tilting toward you whenever you walk in. All the attention and parental love drains into you, never to come back out. You possess gravity out of all proportion to your size. And perhaps your indifference to your own importance makes you even more beloved. I'm learning that I can never compete with you. Despite being older, bigger, smarter, faster, I will lose every race for our parents' time and attention.
I heard that your mother and father, I actually heard them talk about whether they believed it was a mistake to raise Noah at home with his severe disabilities. And I'm curious what you think about that.
I think it was the only choice we could make as a family, given who we are, given how much we love Noah. I think that was the only choice we had. I think we wished we were the kind of people who could put him away, and I think I wish I were the kind of brother who could turn away from Noah. But I know that I can't, and I know my family couldn't. So it wasn't really ever an option for us. It would have been easier for us. It would have been easier for us as a family. I don't believe it would have been easier for Noah, but that's just not who we are, for better or for worse. You know, for better or for worse.
I've got callers lined up around the block here. Let me get a few of them in here, Carl. First, to Nashville, Tennessee. Bethany is on the line. Bethany, welcome to On Point. I appreciate you waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Hi, Carl. I had actually read a couple of articles, little excerpts that you've written before, Carl, and it was the first time that I ever read something that I went, oh, my gosh, that's exactly how I feel or how I felt. I grew up with a severely autistic sister who was also profoundly deaf. So I was adopted into the family when I was two. And I loved my sister, and I loved my sister tremendously at the time. But it always felt like there was a kind of wall, a huge wall between us. So it was always very tentative, and I always knew that I was never the focus of attention. And I have five children of my own now, and, you know, even when one of my girls has strep throat, all of the attention goes to them. So I do understand that how easily it can happen, just the minor illness, much less the autism, but particularly in the teenage years, it was very difficult to kind of fit in anywhere, and Kristen would always become immediately the focus of attention, and So it was tough.
Bethany, thanks so much for the call. Did you share that, Carl? Did you share Bethany's feelings, especially in the teenage years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think one of the great difficulties is that there's always some tension between, between brothers and sisters. And I think that one of the difficulties in Bethany's case or in my case is that we can never really express that because it's never a fair fight in a sense. And I think I go back to something you said earlier about a titanic struggle. I felt that my family was in this titanic struggle, but the titanic struggle was always against Noah's autism, Noah's disability, trying to find what was – first the question is what was wrong with Noah, then it's what can we do with Noah? And we moved across country to get to a better program, then a pioneering program at UCLA, because we thought it might be better for Noah. So we uprooted ourselves and did everything we could. And I think that's ultimately what I want people to understand as families, is that they should do everything they can for their brothers or sisters or their sons or daughters. They have to, try every therapy, leave no stone unturned. But if at the end of it, this autistic person remains in your life, which is the most common result, despite the best intentions and the most wonderful treatments and therapies, you can still find a life and you can still find your way through.
You mentioned moving from New York to Los Angeles to be closer to a pioneering autism program at UCLA. Your family also opened its own daycare center for the developmentally disabled, created a one-on-one assisted living situation for Noah. Years before, that was really common so that you could delay institutionalizing him, did you not?
Yeah. We my mother founded the Palisades Daycare Center, which was a daycare center, because she felt that one of the ironies was that autistic and developmentally disabled children were actually spending less time in school than normal kids. So my mother tried to fix that by starting a daycare center that would provide some more support for a few hours a day.
But his experience in other institutionalized care was not always good, was it?
No, Noah had a tough road as an adult. When he finally left home around 17 or 18, he moved through a series of group homes and finally ended up in a state facility, which was very disappointing in many ways, and in which he was abused and hurt. And it was very hard for my family to see that and to try to accept that. We couldn't accept it. We moved him out of there. But this is one of the terrible realities of some autistic lives is that once the families can no longer care for them, they very often end up in less than ideal situations. And that's one of the things that I believe is important, is that we look at the issue of adult autism in America and realize as a society we're not really prepared to handle this.
Here's another call from Springfield, Massachusetts. Jesse is on the line. Jesse, welcome to On Point.
Hi. I'm also the brother of a severely compromised, shall we say, person. My brother had schizophrenia from the age of 15 till 45 when he died, and I'd say one of the striking examples in our family was that my stepfather completely denied, could not accept that my brother had a problem, even when he went off catatonic twice in an ambulance to a psych ward. Somehow he was judged as, I don't know, I can't get in my stepfather's head. So the judgment was, but the effect, one of the big effects that had on the rest of us is that my brother, myself, our other brother, and my mother have all had major psychiatric problems, hospitalizations, meds, suicide has been in the picture for, I don't want to get into any details, and I haven't even given you my actual name or place out of confidentiality, but the effect was, I would say, touched every aspect of our lives, and I still deal with the fact that, okay, I have a problem that is legitimate and I can do something about it, and I should, because there was so much denial about my brother's schizophrenia for so long. Mm-hmm. And I'm a very loyal brother. I made bridges with him and went to see him when he passed away. Got there to see him a couple of years when he passed away in L.A.
Jesse, thanks so much for the call. Take care. What do you hear in Jesse's story, Carl, the denial and this touching every aspect of their lives?
I think families react to these kind of of disabilities and difficulties in different ways. And I'm not in the position to judge how another family deals with their own traumas. One of the things I wanted to say talk about in this book is one of the key points I wanted to make is that you're not alone in going through this, and you're not alone in having the feelings you have about your brother, your sister. But I can't really project myself into another family situation, circumstance, and really understand necessarily what they're going through.
So what is the obligation or the responsibility that you feel to Noah now as adults?
I think, as I said before, I think Noah will always be in my life. I think I'm going to have to, as my parents age, my father's now 81, my mother's in her late 70s, the conservatorship of Noah is going to fall more and more to me. I'm going to have to take on a much larger role in his life. He's going to take on a larger role in my life. And I think that, you know, what my responsibility to him is exactly as much as I determine it to be, really. I mean, it's interesting that legally there is a parental responsibility, right? I mean, we have that encoded into law. There is no legally defined sibling responsibility. But I accepted, because of how I was raised, because of what my family structure was, I accepted from pretty early on that Noah was going to be in my life my whole life. I don't know if I understood the practical implications of that until I was much older. But at this point, I do see that as being one of the anchors in my life. And I'm very grateful to my parents that they gave me really the years, you know, from college to now, or to just a few years ago, to be relatively free of Noah in a way that I could live my life and have I'm married and I could have my family and not worry about Noah so much, because I think they did that in part because they knew that this stage of my life now upcoming was going to be much more busy with Noah.
Let's get another call in here before our next break. Joan is in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Joan. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, and congratulations to the author for elucidating some of these issues. I am a sibling of a brother who had meningitis and severe, profound brain damage subsequently at age 5 months old. It, as profound as his brain damage was, and that he was a total care, never toileted, never could feed himself, it affected every aspect of my development as profoundly, from my choice of occupations to my choice of husbands, both of whom had siblings with also profound mental problems. So
you empathize with this story quite completely. Joan, thank you so much for your call. Carl Greenfeld, when you see Noah now, when you visit him, what do you see? What goes through your mind?
Depends on what kind of mood he's in. When Noah's in a good mood, he's a sweetheart. And then it's like spending time with anyone else who's all smiles. When Noah's in a crummy mood, it's a very unpleasant afternoon. He's nonverbal, so the only way he can express himself is by hugging you or by pinching you if he's angry. And so the time is really dictated by the state that he's in. And trying to understand why Noah's in a good or bad mood has always been sort of a parlor game in my family, in that my mother and father and I always have different theories as to why Noah's happy or sad in any particular day. But Noah still knows me. I mean, he clearly knows me, and I still know him, and we sometimes warily coexist, and we're sometimes very happy together.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're getting a sibling's eye view of the challenges of growing up with an autistic brother, with Carl Greenfeld. He's the author of a touching new memoir called Boy Alone, a brother's memoir about his brother who had severe autism, has severe autism. Here's an interview, Carl, I'd like to play. It's a 1978 interview on 60 Minutes, where your father talked about your mother's fears about your brother Noah, how scared she was becoming of him as he got bigger and stronger, that she was afraid someday he would kill her. Here's what your father told Dan Rather.
When she says to me, hey, I can't go on, I don't know what to do, take Noah to Cambridge, to put Noah in an institution or something, but, you know, I'm dying, he's going to kill me, and I think, hell, kill him first before he destroys my wife, before he destroys myself.
Obviously very raw, very honest. Did you ever feel that as his brother, Carl?
Well, I was always bigger than him, so that changes the dynamic a little bit. My mother is at her peak was 5 feet tall. So as Noah entered puberty, which is, as we know, a difficult and unruly time for anyone, he became more aggressive and more violent. And my mother, being the primary caregiver and the one who really did the most with Noah and would work with him every day and work on his behavioral therapies and do everything she could for him. My mother was the one who was most interacting with him and therefore was most prone to his tantrums and his outbursts. And I, at that age, was big enough and strong enough physically to handle him. We had our fights. I don't know any set of brothers who don't have their fights. And our fights were probably actually, they weren't as bad as some that I've seen in my life. But all of this added up to, I think, this sense of desperation in my family that really began around that age, a little bit earlier, of we have to find a place for Noah. We have to find some kind of solution to this problem. And that conversation, which very quickly replaced the what's wrong with Noah and how can we treat Noah conversation, became the dominant one of my teenage years, where we were always trying to figure out where can we find a good place for Noah. This was when all the scandals were happening, especially in Camarillo, a state hospital in California. There had been a lot of patient deaths due to negligence, and we knew we couldn't put Noah there. We visited the facility, and it was terrifying. Yet we were increasingly feeling we didn't have the resources to keep Noah at home. So that, I think, is a conversation that a lot of families can relate to, that issue of what do we do with the child or the boy or the daughter and how can we find a place for him or her. Hmm. And compounding that for me is this mystery at the heart of Noah, which is I can never have a conversation with him. So as much as there is this kind of tension in the family, Noah remains at the center of it, but Noah remains such a cipher because he can never speak. I don't know what he's thinking. Nobody knows what he's thinking. And that, looking back, is sort of one of the great sadnesses and absences of my life, which is I've never had a conversation with my brother. And my deepest, fondest wish to this day is that I could have that conversation with him. And in part, this book, Boy Alone, is an attempt to finally have that conversation with my brother, and I do it in this book in a rather extensive sequence. We have we have that conversation that I always dreamed of having with him.
Yes.
Because one of the great, you know, regrets of having a brother who's profoundly autistic like Noah is that I don't know him in the way that I know my own wife or my own children, in that I can talk to him and understand the landscape of his mind a little bit. I just don't. And I every day I think about that and feel that loss.
Here's a call from Nashua, New Hampshire. Benita is on the line calling. Welcome to On Point, Benita.
Hi there, Jane. Hi, Hi there, Carl.
Hi.
I want to say from the very inside of my heart and my existence and my coexistence with an older sister who was mentally retarded, that it's nice to see that we in this day and age can air the feelings within families that way back in the 50s and 60s were hidden. There are so many dynamics that affect every day of my life that sprung from that time. One of the questions is, I wonder if your parents had an expectation of you to be the perfect child, and if you felt that sort of overarching pressure.
Mm. Benita, thank you. Carl?
I think there was increased concern when my academic performance would dip, forget being a perfect child, would dip into being just a straight-up crummy student, which I was. I was never a very good student. I was never very diligent. I was never hardworking. And my mother in particular was always worried about that. My mother's Japanese and so therefore hypersensitive about matters of education. And when she saw that I was really floundering in mathematics and not much of an academic, she became very alarmed and increased the scrutiny on my lessons. I don't think my parents ever expected me to be a perfect child. I think they became doubly concerned, however, when it turned out I was really not a very good student at school. So I think it was more the worry that, oh no, we already have Noah, we already have this one child who we know is compromised. They would look at me and really worry that what if I was a second one, especially when teenage dope smoking and all that stuff began, when I began to act out and misbehave in a more cliched manner. I think that really concerned them, that somehow that I was also going down the same road and that I was going to end up somehow a disappointment, not as much as Noah perhaps, but in my own way.
Here's another call from Melinda. She's in Somerville, South Carolina. Melinda, welcome to On Point. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm a parent of an autistic child. My son is 8 years old, and he has a 4-year-old neurotypical sister, which is what in the autism world how we refer to our normal kids. And you know, I am concerned about what happens to my son when he gets older, but also what happens to my daughter. Will she feel pressured to take care of her brother? Because I don't want to pressure her to take care of her brother, but yet I hope that she'll want to be a part of his life. And I'm wondering if the guest felt pressured at all to take care of his brother growing up.
Melinda, thank you.
No, I don't think my parents ever pressured me or told me that I was going to have to take care of Noah. I think as an adult, my parents and I had that conversation, and we still have that conversation. But as I said, throughout my childhood, I always felt like I was brought into that discussion about Noah and was another, almost another party at the table as we would try to wrestle with what to do with Noah. So whether that was a form of pressure, whether that was just the dynamics of my family, which was quite, we were quite open and we shared our opinions about what was going on, that pulled me into caring and worrying about Noah, whether I wanted to or not.
Melinda's call, Carl, brings up a really interesting and important part of your book and really this conversation, which is what do you do with these kids when they grow up, when they become adults, when they are autistic adults or severely disabled adults? What's the answer?
We're not even at the stage in this where we can talk about what the answer might be. We're at the stage in this where we have to acknowledge that there's a problem and now have to go out and look for the programs that are in place out there in the country and try to survey the best practices and say, this is working, this is not working. Now let's try to scale up those programs out there that are working, because there really isn't much funding going toward the adult autistic. There isn't much academic research on the subject. By and large, autism has been portrayed as a childhood condition. This is in part because it's easier to raise awareness and raise money if you're showing kids rather than adults. And so within the media, within society, there is this idea that autism is somehow a childhood issue and that maybe the kids grow out of it. Maybe with intense applied behavioral therapies, you're going to have kids who can recover from autism. And that, I think, is a little bit of the perception gap that's out there right now. The reality is most autistics remain in some state autistic throughout their whole life. Mm-hmm. And so the media focus on childhood isn't necessarily helpful in terms of trying to orient the conversation to become to be more effective and more useful. And as you go to conferences and go through the sort of the autism community, there's an intense amount of research on childhood, on early intervention, on all those issues, and really almost none on adults. It's just beginning now. I mean, this year the NIH Autism Survey for the first time included lifespan issues as one of their focuses. And one of their areas where they would like to see more funding and more research, because at this point we haven't even begun to really have that conversation yet as a society, and even within the autism community, that conversation is finally only just beginning.
You just mentioned, Carl, stories of miraculous healings and children who go on to have a normal life. I know you've read so many books about autism. You call them hope manuals, I think is what I heard you say. What about the very public stories of people like Jenny McCarthy, who believed that her son was cured of autism, changing his diet, vitamin supplementation, detox of metals, all of these things, this sort of miraculous recovery? What's your take on that?
I think it's wonderful for Jenny McCarthy and her son that this happened. I don't know that that's necessarily going to be replicated widely. I don't know that every family that tries that therapy is going to have the same result. But I would never discourage the family of an autistic boy or girl from trying everything that they feel they have to try, and to leave no stone unturned as they try to heal their son or daughter. But don't feel in any way that you're a failure if you don't succeed. Don't feel that your child not becoming unautistic is somehow a shortcoming on the part of the family, because it isn't. And one of the things that concerns me now is this idea that if you somehow don't do all these things that the Jenny McCarthy's of the world and so forth recommend and suggest and believe in, that you have somehow let your boy down. And the truth is, my family tried so many multivitamins, diet, so many of these things that are currently the fad, the gluten allergies and all this stuff. They've been around since the 70s. None of these ideas are particularly new. And my family went through different phases with each of them. Unfortunately, Noah remained profoundly autistic. Noah never got that magical solution that Jenny McCarthy's boy got. And what I'm trying to say in Boy Alone is, even if you don't get that, even if you end up with this autistic person in your life your whole life, that's okay too. You will get through it. You will get through it, and the family will make it through, and you can even thrive in your own way.
Here's another call from Johns Island, South Carolina. Jenny is on the line. Jenny, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
I have been listening, and I'm very grateful to your guest. I'm going to talk about, for just a second, the other side of the story, mm-hmm. because I have a congenital mobility issue. It's some sort of muscular dystrophy. And, of course, that consumed my mother's time and efforts. And my older brother has always been very jealous of me. And it was a mystery to me, because I would have traded places with him at any time. I want to say that I have gone on to have a totally normal life. But my position as the person who had the disability in the family, and because I was very cognizant of what was going on around me, I was cognizant of the jealousy of my sibling, as well as, and this is something that perhaps your guest talked about that I did not hear, the guilt of the mother in the fact that she was somehow responsible for my disability. And so I appreciate the elucidation that has come from listening to your guest. Do you have any comments?
Jenny, thank you very much. Carl, you respond?
I'm not sure I understand the concept of the guilt of the mother in her responsibility for the disability. I think that gets in pretty treacherous ground in that we're going back to this idea of somehow blaming the parents for the disability. I think we reject that. One of the things that I worry about now is that with the popularity of someone like Jenny McCarthy and the success she's having, that and this idea that you know the warrior mother heals her son or daughter, if we're somehow going back to that if you still have this autistic person in your life, somehow you're a failure as a mother and that you should be blamed. Fortunately, my mother never accepted that notion, which was then popular when Noah was first diagnosed. This was the period when Bruno Bettelheim sort of dominated the autism business, and the refrigerator mother was currently believed to be the cause of her son's autism. Fortunately, my mother rejected that in part because she had me. I was an older brother, and I was, you know, quote unquote normal. So I'm reluctant to get into any sort of blaming the parent. I think it's also very easy to beat yourself up for giving more attention to one kid versus the other. As I said before, I think it's inevitable in families that this stuff gets disproportional. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get that balance exactly right.
I only have about 20 seconds left, Carl. I wonder if there's a moral in the story of your brother, Noah, to wrap us up here.
Well, I think there is a moral, and I think there is a lesson, and that is that as families, you will get through it. It's despairing, and it's difficult, and it's hard. And my book is very unflinching in addressing that. But as a family, you can and you will get through it.
Well, thank you, Carl Greenfeld. The new book is Boy Alone, A Brother's Memoir. It's an incredible story. Carl, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.